Radio.
Catholic Feminism, an oxymoron? A talk by Professor Celia Hammond for the Dawson Society.
Thanks for that introduction, Tom. I stopped lecturing before they introduced PowerPoint, so I'm a slide girl, so I'm going to struggle with this, but I'll do my best. Tom and a number of his colleagues approached me a while ago when they were setting up the Dawson Society, and it's I'm just so honoured and thrilled that I did get the opportunity to meet with them at the time that they were setting it up. And I think it is an absolutely incredible endeavour. I think it's absolutely marvellous. I'm also extremely nervous. Now, most people would think, you know, you lecture, you can hear me, you can't hear me. All right, you can. All right. I'm also nervous. You think that when you lecture and you've taught and you've spoken to groups of people, you don't get nervous, but then sad reality is you do. So bear with me a while. Now, Tom has actually stolen quite a bit of my speech, talking about first wave feminism and second wave feminism, but, you know. The reason why I have chosen this topic is that a couple of years ago, someone close to me said, in a passing but obviously genuinely held belief, that you cannot be a feminist if you do not support abortion. Now, it was at the end of a conversation that I was having with this particular person, and if I recall correctly, my response was along the lines of, what? But the conversation ended. She was hopping into a car. The comment, however, stayed with me, and at various times, this would be about 2 years ago now, at various times it's come back to me and made me think about it. Because if you accept the assertion that you cannot be a feminist if you do not support abortion, then surely this would mean that you cannot be a feminist if you are Catholic. So if the assertion you cannot be a feminist if you do not support abortion is correct, I would say the logical conclusion to that is you cannot be a feminist if you are Catholic. And it's this question that I want to explore tonight. Can you be a Catholic feminist? Is the notion of Catholic feminism an oxymoron? Now, I'm sure that all of you know what an oxymoron is, but I did actually have to go back and check on it when I came up with the title to the speech to make sure I was using it in its correct way. An oxymoron, according to the OED, is a contradiction in terms. A figure of speech in which a pair of opposed or markedly contradictory terms are placed in conjunction for emphasis. So is Catholic feminism an oxymoron? Now, just by way of setting the scene, just from the outset, I would like to provide some context. Because as much as I would dearly love to, hand on heart, say that I can approach this topic objectively, I do believe that the comments that I'm going to make, my interpretations, my views, are consciously or unconsciously shaped by me as a person. By this I mean the thoughts, reflections and points of view that I'm going to put across this evening are probably shaped as much by my objective reading and research as they are by my experiences, by my faith, by my beliefs and by my life circumstances. So at the outset, a little bit of disclaimer. I'm not actually claiming to come to this from an objective viewpoint, an objective standpoint. I think many times, if truth be told, whenever we approach any issue, to say that you're approaching it objectively is a big and tough call to make. So just a bit of background for context so that whatever comments I make, you can put within that context of where I'm coming from. I do not approach this question because my self-identity is tied to being a feminist. I do not approach this question by trying to reconcile my faith with a chosen identity as feminist. In many ways, my approach is from the opposite end. I have never identified myself or called myself a feminist. During my formative years in the 80s, which wasn't when I was little, by formative, I mean, you know, late teens, early 20s. Feminism, which the 80s were also, as I was just talking, best music decade in the past 60 years. during my formative years in the 1980s, feminism to me was associated with man-hating, anti-everything agitators. Feminism to those, many of the people within my generation growing up becoming of age in the 1980s, was an aggressive, anti-the-world approach to life. So I never called myself a feminist. And I acknowledge now that at that time, and even now, I am probably the type, well, at that stage, I was the type of young woman that an earlier generation of women, including my mother, would have been legitimately frustrated with. These earlier generations of women who did identify with some aspects of the feminist movement fought and struggled to get equal rights to higher education. They fought and struggled to get equal rights to employment, to equal legal recognition. And what would have seen with me as a young woman in the 80s and to those of my generation in denying or categorically saying we're not feminist is effectively, here is the fruit of our labours. Here is somebody who is getting all the benefit of what we struggled for, and they're biting the hand that fed them. We went through this and now they're categorically saying that they're not feminist. Throughout my schooling in the 70s and 80s, I was never disadvantaged because of being female. There were no subjects refused to me to study. Now, I do remember I had to study home economics until year 10, and I don't believe that that's now compulsory for girls, but that's about the only element that was still persistent in 1980s in school education. During my formative years, I could legitimately dream, and dream I did, about studying anything post-school and moving into a career in any field. I could and did dream about having a family, having a career, and having an everything life. I grew up in a family of three sisters and no brothers. There was never any comparison in my family based on gender. So it was never a case of boys doing one thing and girls doing another thing. It was more a case of dad hiding at work or coming home and screaming at us to stop fighting with each other and slamming doors. I grew up in a middle-class white family in a country town and then the suburbs of Western Australia. Not spoilt materially, but certainly not wanting for anything. I was educated in Catholic schools in the post-Vatican II world. I studied law at a public university. And like many of my generation, and perhaps many throughout time, throughout certain stages of my life, particularly my late teens and early 20s, my faith went through periods of serious weakness. So that's the background, that's the context. And thus, if there's any bias or any lack of objectivity to what I'm saying this evening, it could be that my approach, or I would say that it's my approach to the question of whether you can be a Catholic feminist, is one of someone who is predisposed to answering the question in the negative. So I'm not coming from a perspective of trying to prove to you or trying to establish, because it's somehow subjectively tied up with me, that you can have Catholic feminism. If anything, it comes from the opposite, that I don't think that you can. Now, before I start looking at whether it's an oxymoron, to start with a couple of brief definitions. Feminism. The word feminism has a number of different meanings noted in the OED. You can also look at Wiki, but I'm not quoting Wiki, okay? I've gone back to a dictionary. At least the OED, I think, has a little bit more credit than Wikipedia. The number of definitions of feminism in the OED, the most common, the one that they identify as the one the most commonly in current use, is that it's current usage as advocacy of the equality of the sexes and the establishment of the political, social and economic rights of the female sex and the movement associated with this. Feminist is defined in its adjectival sense of or relating to or advocating the rights and equality of women. On their face, both of these definitions are relatively benign. Why couldn't a Catholic be in support of feminism, or why couldn't a Catholic be feminist? Now, there are also numerous definitions provided in the OED to the word Catholic. what I will just put forward now, and I don't actually have it on the slide, is that a Catholic is a person, is a member or adherent of the Roman Catholic Church. And that is somebody who subscribes to the teachings, creeds, beliefs and doctrines of the Catholic Church. That could be another topic that could consume hours as to what is a Catholic, but I'll stick with that definition there. Now, just focusing on feminism in the world. I'll do it slightly longer than Tom did, but not much. Until the Industrial Revolution, women in the Western world, now this is also important to note, that feminism and its movement over the last 100 to 200 years has really been, until recent times, driven by white middle-class women. Until the Industrial Revolution, in the Western world, women were largely wives or mothers. In the case of Catholic women, many were nuns and religious sisters. There were, of course, exceptions. In the late 19th and early 20th century, what is now sometimes referred to as the first wave of feminism occurred in the Western world. Now, it is said to the genesis of it, it did start to happen at an earlier phase in both USA and in France, but it is really the late 19th and early 20th century that it took off. The first wave, as Tom said, focused mainly on legal gender rights, voting rights, female education rights, better working conditions and property rights. By the end of the first wave period, many women, or the majority of women in many parts of the Western world, were granted the right to vote, and a number of legal obstacles to their participation in society were abolished. Now, it's also relevant to note here that some of the earliest advocates in this first wave of feminists, in this first feminist wave, were strong conservative Christian women. During the two world wars, there's a sort of a gap between the first wave of feminism and the second wave of feminism. During the two world wars and during the intervening Great Depression, many women in the Western world entered the workforce because of necessity. It is said that at the end of World War II, with women being effectively forced out of the workforce for the returning men, that the genesis of the second wave of feminism started. And it's said, if you look at feminist literature, that the second wave of feminism started in the late 60s and early 1970s and ended sometime in the 1980s, although some would say it's still not ended. It's still recent enough history not to be able to put a certain end date on it. Women often, or writers associated with the second wave of feminism, include Betty Friedan, Simone de Beauvoir, Gloria Steinem, Germaine Greer. Now, the initial focus during this second wave of feminism was on equality in the workforce. Same pay, same access to permanency. I still recall my mother, who in the late 1950s and early 1960s, who was a teacher, when she got engaged, was forced to resign. Or no, she lost her permanency, and then when she got pregnant, she was forced to resign. So it's those sort of conditions within in very recent history. So this second wave of feminism originally focused on those sorts of issues. But it soon morphed into other spheres, including family and sexuality, what some refer to as cultural equality. Now, as the period moved on, the movement increased in militancy in some areas, with some becoming not just pro-woman, but anti-tradition, anti-men, anti-society, anti-family. Reproduction rights and the rights of women, of a woman, to have full control over her body became cornerstones of a large part of the feminist movement. It's important to note here that if you do actually read any feminist literature, it didn't take over all those involved within feminism. But it certainly became, because of the militancy and because of the capacity of a certain cohort of women advocating for feminism and advocating for particularly reproductive rights, the right to abortion, because of their ability and what they managed to do in terms of formalising and getting a very large voice, that is what the second wave is now largely known as. But it wasn't or is now largely characterised as, but it certainly wasn't everybody involved with the feminist movement in the second wave. According to some writers, we're now in a third wave of feminism. Now, this is said by some to be a backlash against the predominantly first world white woman focus of the second wave of feminism, and it is said to be more diverse, picking up on issues such as race and culture. We're supposedly still in the third wave of feminism, and if you do any reading, you'll see that there's different strands to it, but that is seems to be the predominant one, that it is a backlash against the second wave and what was perceived to be the white woman, Western world focus of second wave. Now, if you look at, and I just want to go through some statistics. So there's three waves of feminism, late 18th, early 19th century, no, late 19th, early 20th century through to 21st century, which is what we're in now. Looking back historically, people now classify them as first wave, second wave, and apparently we're in a third wave. To put that into some sort of context, I think it's interesting to note the position of women in society over that time period. And what I have just picked up on, because rather than focusing on the entire Western world, picked up on some statistics in the story of Australian women throughout that time period to show how their lives have changed, particularly in the last 60 years or so. I'll come to a conclusion later on as to whether this is just the result of feminism or whether it's the result of other things. More Australian women are educated than ever before. Until 1987, more men than women were enrolled in higher education. In the 1950s, only 20% of students enrolled in higher education were women. In 2011, 57% of students enrolled in higher education in Australia are women. So 57% of entire university population, and there's over a million now studying in universities in Australia, are women. Majority of them study management and commerce, which is exactly like men, and that's 25%. 22% study courses within society and culture, 14% study in health, and 14% study in education. So we now have more women in universities than men. In 2011, 57% of men and 56% of women aged between 15 and 64 had a non-school qualification. So that means not just higher education but tertiary as well, so VET qualifications. In 2009, 34% of men and 40% of women aged 25 to 64 had a tertiary qualification. So until 1987, there were more males than females studying at universities or in higher education. Now the situation is completely reversed. More women in universities studying higher education degrees, and there's more women out there with higher education degrees. There are no limitations on what women can study in tertiary education in Australia, none that I'm aware of. Secondly, more Australian women are in the workforce than ever before. In 2011, 69% of women aged between 18 to 34 were in the workforce. In 1976, that percentage was 54%. So 69% of women between 18 and 34 and 79% of men. 45% of these women work part-time. In 2011, 59% of all women are in the workforce. In 1961, this was 34%. So from 1961 to 2011, we've gone from 34% of women in the workforce to 59% of women in the workforce. The percentage of men, just to balance this out, in the workforce has actually declined. In 1961, 82% of men were in the workforce. In 2011, it was 72% of men were in the workforce. The career choices available to women to pursue include all those available to men, although I have put a question mark here about the armed forces. I'm still not sure whether that's changed or not. But effectively, there are no career limitations on women in 2011. Some other statistics about Australian women, Australian woman today compared with years gone past. Australian women have fewer children. In 1960, the rate was 2.8 children per woman. In 2011, it's 1.9 children per woman. Australian women have children later in life. In 1980, the median age of a woman giving birth for the first time was 26 years. In 2011, the median age is 28.9 years. In the 1950s, it was in the early 20s. The highest fertility rate for women is much later than it was in previous years. In the 1950s, most babies were born when mothers were aged between 20 and 24. In 2011, most babies are born when women are aged between 30 and 34, so 10 years. More children are born outside registered marriage. In 1990, 22% of babies were born outside marriage, and the average age of the woman was 24 years. In 2010, 34% of babies were born outside marriage, and the average age of the woman was 27.3 years. More women cohabit with their partners before marriage. In 1975, 16% of couples cohabited before they got married. In 2010, 79% of couples cohabited before marriage. It should also be noted that in 2010, 11% of Australians aged 18 and over were living in de facto relationships. 53% were in registered marriages, 11% in de facto relationships. And that statistic, as you go down in the years, for people aged between 20 and 29, 22% live in de facto relationships. Women are getting married later. In the 1950s, the median age of the bride was 22.6. In 2010, the median age for the bride was 27.9. There are also more divorces. In the 1950s, there were 0.7 divorces per 1,000 people. In 2010, 2.3 divorces per 1,000 people. Women and men are both getting divorced later in life, but statistically they're also getting married later in life, so it actually hasn't changed much. The average period that they stay married is pretty much the same. And it should be noted that 50% of all divorces in Australia have children involved at less than 18. So 50% of those that get divorced, there are children involved under the age of 18. Now, one good point to this is that back in 1990, it was 56% of divorces had children under 18. So there's been some positive movement there in that it's decreased to 50%. The world has changed for Australian women dramatically over that time period. More educated, more in the workforce, more choices. The majority of young women today, either leaving school or in their formative years, as I call them, face almost limitless choice and opportunities about what to do as they become adults. They're not restricted in their life choices. They can choose to marry, they can choose to be single. They can choose to be in a partnership without marriage. They can choose if and when they will have children. Now, that choice and opportunity is liberating and it's empowering. And as I always say to my mother, we're thankful for all those women that have gone before us to give us that choice and that opportunity. But it is also a huge challenge, because the world that we live in today is also one that is full of mixed messages and contradictions. We have a popular culture today which emphasises the individual, the material and the superficial, where we, or where young women, and I'm just focusing on women here, are told that you can achieve fame, celebrity and or notoriety, perhaps all three, by going on a reality TV show or simply uploading a video, and I think it's uploading, to YouTube, or pictures on Facebook. And moreover, it's a culture in which this fame, celebrity or notoriety is something to aspire to. It's held up to be a good in itself to get this celebrity or notoriety. It's a world in which women are constantly being told, young women, either directly or more subtly through the usage of images and advertising, that women can do whatever they want to do, be whatever they want to be, it's the superwoman myth of having it all, although I'm still not quite sure what having it all means. It is also a world in which there is a very pervasive and at times subtle anti-family, anti-traditional structure, culture. So not only are all these opportunities and these choices opened up, and not only is there this superficial culture, there is also a culture that sometimes overtly and sometimes far more subtly, anti-family, anti-tradition. Having children is now, and I'd say ever since I was in my formative years, is now portrayed as being a huge sacrifice. Now, all of us with Christian faith know that sacrifices aren't necessarily bad, and that actually to make sacrifices is actually a virtue, that, you know, sacrificing, self-sacrifice is a good thing. But the world that is portraying sacrifice, motherhood and family as sacrifice, is portraying it as a negative. It is portrayed as a negative. You will sacrifice yourself. You will sacrifice your identity if you marry, if you have children. The feminist movement, first wave, second wave, and third wave, is undoubtedly responsible for many of the both positive and negative aspects of today's culture. So I wouldn't be standing here educated, in full-time employment, and with three children if it wasn't for the likes of early pioneers in the feminist movement. But likewise, the changes that we've seen to our culture and to society, particularly the anti-tradition, the anti-family, is also attributable to that same feminist movement. Now, there may well be many other factors involved as well, in terms of some people blame it on capitalism, some people blame it on globalisation. Of course, there's never a single factor to any of these things, but what I'm saying is undoubtedly feminism has had an impact, both positive and resulted in both positive and negative changes. That's the rise of feminism. To answer the question whether you can be a Catholic feminist or whether Catholic feminism is actually an oxymoron, do have to go back and look at, well, what does the church actually say about women? And I thought I'd start with a statement made at the end of Vatican II. So this was in 1965. The hour is coming, in fact has come, when the vocation of women is being acknowledged in its fullness, the hour in which women acquire in the world an influence, an effect, and a power never hitherto achieved. I love that word, hitherto. I occasionally use it now. So that's Vatican II Council's message to women in 1965. Now, just as a brief prelude to this, it's a common mistake for all of us to make, to think that things that happen are only happening now and that they've never happened before. I recently became accustomed, and I'm ashamed to say it, mid-40s, not quite mid yet, has only become acquainted with Edith Stein, St. Teresa Benedicta of the Cross, within the last 12 months, but I've now become a huge devotee. So just to deviate backwards from the Vatican II statement to a statement that St. Teresa Benedicta of the Cross made in the 1930s about women. So this was in Germany in the 1930s. Both of these statements I think are absolutely magnificent and are just as relevant today as they were probably in the 1930s. Only subjective delusion could deny that women are capable of practicing vocations other than that of a spouse and mother. The experiences of the last decades, and for that matter, the experience of all times, has demonstrated this. One could say that in the case of need, every normal and healthy woman is able to hold a position, and there is no profession which cannot be practiced by a woman. And the one that actually resonates far better. Many of the best women are almost overwhelmed by the double burden of family duties and professional life, or often simply of only gainful employment. Always on the go, they are harassed, nervous, and irritable. I put that outside my office door just to warn people before they come in. Harassed, nervous, and irritable. So, Edith Stein, Vatican II. And as I said, this is just a brief prelude. In fact, it does have relevance because the work of Edith Stein, by those who've studied the writings of Pope John Paul II in great detail, they see the influence of Edith Stein on his writings on the theology of the body. So there is a link there. I didn't just put it in for no reason. Vatican II, and the statement that I started with, laid the framework for the beautiful and profound church teachings about the special nature of women, the feminine genius, which has been articulated so powerfully and clearly in the decades following the Council. Now, I should note here that these teachings are firmly rooted in sacred scripture and tradition. They are not new in the sense of being a break from the old. Rather, they are the ripening, the developing, the fleshing out, and they emerged as distinct teachings post-Vatican II because the Church recognised and clearly identified at Vatican II that because women's lives were changing dramatically and quickly in the world, special attention needed to be given to women to help them deal with the challenges and opportunities in the changing world. So all of all that's been written about the special genius of women post-Vatican II is not a break from the old, but it's an example of the Church responding to the needs of society at a particular point in time. So the Church's teaching on women come from a number of sources. Before Vatican II, the Old Testament, numerous examples of wonderful and exemplar women in the Old Testament, the Gospels, women saints. Pope John 23rd wrote a number of documents which referred specifically to women. The Vatican II documents listed up there all made special reference to women. And post-Vatican II, as I said earlier, is the era in which the special teachings of women and women in the Church and the recognition of women by the Church came into its own. And there are a number of the documents up there post-Vatican II. Some of the most profound teachings following Vatican II came from Pope John Paul II. Pope Benedict also picked up on the theme, both when he was in the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, and then when he was Pope, and as Tom's pointed out, Pope Francis has started to enunciate his own way of expressing it as well. Other documents include our own Australian bishops undertaking a major research project in the late 1990s, Woman and Man, One in Jesus Christ, the 1993 Catechism of the Catholic Church. If you've got it online, or if you've got the hard copy, if you've got it online, do a search on woman. If you've got a hard copy, go to the index like we used to in the old days, and you'll find countless references to women in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. There was also a document in 2004 from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, and it was written when Pope Benedict was actually Cardinal Ratzinger, which is also a magnificent document fleshing out how the Church understands women, how it explores their role. Now, there's not enough time, nor am I the right person, not being a theologian, to go through these teachings and these documents individually or necessarily in depth. Rather, what I thought I might do is pick up on some key themes that emerge from these documents and just explore them a little bit to show about or to help demonstrate the Church's teaching on women. And remember, the ultimate aim being here, the Church's teaching on women, is it consistent at all with feminism? Can you actually marry the two together? So just looking at some key themes. How am I going for time? All right, okay. Okay, one of the first major key themes about the Church's teaching on women is the equality and of dignity of man and woman. Go back to Genesis, for heaven's sake. God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. The Catechism. Each of the two sexes is an image of the power and tenderness of God, with equal dignity, though in a different way. And in Mulieris Dignitatem, man is a person, man and woman equally so, since both were created in the image and likeness of the personal God. The church has always told us, has always taught, all are equal in dignity because of what we are. And what we are is completely unrelated to what we do, what talents or gifts we possess. And this is an absolutely beautiful, absolutely profound starting point. We are equal in dignity because of what we are, created in the image and likeness of God, and that applies to men and to women. Second theme that comes through the church's teaching, equality as a citizen. This theme has an exemplar in Pope John Paul II's 1995 letter to women. As far as personal rights are concerned, there is an urgent need to achieve real equality in every area. Equal pay for equal work, protection for working mothers, fairness in career advancements, equality of spouses with regards to family rights, and the recognition of everything that is part of the rights and duties of citizens in a democratic state. There are numerous examples of these. I've got a number of quotes here. But both pre- and post-Vatican II, it is very clear that not only has the Catholic Church taught that man and women are equal in dignity, it is also clear that man and woman have equality as citizens. I should note that Pope John Paul II clearly acknowledged that there may well have been times where the Church failed to live by the truth of women having equality as citizens, not equality in dignity as persons, but in equality as citizens. And on numerous occasions, he acknowledged this and showed a firm repentance and apology for the fact that the Church may not have always recognised women as having equality, as being equal in citizenship. Now, at the same time as clearly articulating and indeed advocating for equality, the Church has also clearly articulated that men and women are different. Now, I know that some people would think, any sceptic, he would say, okay, here comes the but clause. That is, men and women are equal, but. Now, the lawyer in me refuses to use the word but, because there are certain connotations. If you're constructing a sentence and you make a statement and you put a but, whatever follows is seen as a negative. It's seen as a qualifying statement. So if I say you're nice but, you know what's coming is a diminution. So I'm not going to, and some church documents, and I'll just say it's because they've been translated from another language, perhaps it's the translator's fault as opposed to the theologians, that I refuse to phrase it in a way that puts that negative connotation. What the church says is actually a positive. It's not a negative qualification. It's not a diminution. It's not meant to be anything restrictive. And what the church says is that men and women are equal in all of their differences. It's a life-affirming, it's a life-giving addition to the first statement. Men and women are equal in all of their differences, as opposed to, but they are different. Now, there are plenty of documents that you could go to find the source of the church's statement regarding the differences between man and woman. I will give you just one. Woman complements man just as man complements woman. Men and women are complementary. Womanhood expresses the human as much as manhood does, but in a different and complementary way. The Church's teaching on complementarity are, as comprehensively explained in many documents, firmly rooted in sacred scripture. Now, some of the, and the best document to go through, the best papal document to go through to actually explore the theological underpinnings would be Mulieris Dignitatem. It explains the theological basis underpinning this notion of complementarity in very short and layman's terms. The key things to pick out here is that complementarity is a distinction, not a diminution. It's not about superiority of one over the other. It's not a ranking system of which one is better. It is simply what it is. When the church talks about differences and complementarity between man and woman, it is a recognition and explanation of the differences. Some of the key aspects to the differences, and I am relying heavily on the work of others here, I would say, particularly Anna Crone. One of the key differences expressed by Pope John Paul II, and as I've said, as I've come to understand through the workings and writings of others, is the notion of the feminine genius, the genius of woman. The feminine genius, and this is to quote Anna Crone, can be understood as the full and authentic spiritual, ethical, and interpersonal response to the given of being a particular female person, a physical, emotional, historical, and spiritual whole. It is present in the heart of a woman like a seed. It needs to be respected, nourished, and allowed to develop in each woman according to her talents, personality, and most importantly, according to her free response. The feminine genius, and I am very aware that I've gone completely over time here, expresses itself in a number of ways. The capacity for others. And this is the link to the feminine genius. So it's the main thing. It's linked to the capacity, the motherhood, the capacity to give life. This capacity for other, the capacity to give life, comes through in different ways. Empathy, an adeptness at creating spaces, places and situations in which people can flourish, that's from Edith Stein, and the building and development of interpersonal relationships. Now, what the church is teaching here is not that these are exclusively female traits, but the church's view, as expressed by those and explained by those who interpret church documents, is that they are more predominant characteristics in women. And in some women, they're more fully fleshed out than in others, and they might also be characteristics and traits that are in men. And if you want to read Edith Stein on this sort of area and on characteristics is excellent. The final theme when it comes to the church's view on women is a very important one. The church is calling every woman to realise her own dignity, to recognise and develop their own feminine genius. The church calls women to be a gift of ourselves and to contribute as a woman. So we are equal and we are different, and we are called to bring our different equalness to make a gift of that to the world. The church sees this not only as a question of justice, but of necessity. Church documents talk about society and the world not actually flourishing unless there is both man and woman, and acting in their capacity, acting in their nature as man and woman. Only then does society have a true chance to flourish. Back to the original question, can a Catholic woman, or can anyone, be a Catholic feminist? Or is it an oxymoron? For the last 2 weeks, I've gone backwards and forwards on this. You'll be pleased to know. Going back to the OED definition of feminism, I would say there's nothing contrary in the OED definition of feminist to say that you can't be a Catholic feminist. The OED definition, remember, was that feminism is the advocacy of the equality of the sexes and the establishment of the political, social and economic rights of the female sex. Taken at face value, that is consistent with absolutely everything that the Catholic Church teaches. However, and this is where I've now turned the other way, language and definitions are not precise, and their interpretation and their application changes over time, and it is shaped by many different things. After having done, and I spend a lot of time searching on the web too, because that's the new place to go to find out about popular culture, or maybe it's Facebook, which I don't even know anything about. The word feminism originally and still in some quarters covers a multitude of movements and of beliefs. But I would assert that at this particular point in time, feminism is too closely entwined at a societal level with pro-abortion, pro-sexual liberation, anti-men, anti-tradition, anti-family. And sorry, when I say sexual liberation, I've got a huge note here. Sexual liberation is not liberation, but that's, again, an entirely different conversation. But the word feminism today, I think, is too closely associated with such things as pro-abortion, pro-sexual liberation, anti-men, anti-family, anti-tradition, that I would argue that Catholic feminism would be construed or understood as to be oxymoronic, i.e. what feminism is perceived to be in the wider world makes Catholic feminism an oxymoron. As a final point, that's where I finished. Yes, I think it is, unless we reclaim the word feminism. Sister Prudence Allen, who I had the benefit of hearing at a conference we held in Sydney about a month or so ago, made a strong argument for the word gender to be reclaimed. And there is now a body of work calling for a new feminism, including Pope Benedict mentioning a new feminism. And this new feminism is one that is being put forward as being consistent with Catholic principles and beliefs. If you read the works of Sister Prudence Allen, of Marianne Glendon, Elizabeth Fox Genovese, see the works being done as we speak tonight in the States by Helen Alvari, Erica Bacciocchi, it's Italian, so that would be a CH as a Bacciocchi, see? There is a new movement trying to reclaim the word feminism. And it's a movement which is in focusing on encouraging women to be who they are, and one which, rather than seeing men and women as enemies, sees them as collaborators. So my conclusion is currently it's an oxymoron unless we reclaim the word feminism, and we associate and clearly associate the word feminism with collaborators, with complementarity, or with something I read late last night, family feminism. Unless the word can be reclaimed, my conclusion today is that it is an oxymoron. And I'll finish there.
That was Professor Celia Hammond with Catholic Feminism, an Oxymoron. For more, visit DawsonSociety.com.au or cradio.org.au.